Go to 702.co.za now to enter the 2020 Dis-Chem Brain of 702. Sponsored by Dis-Chem. Promises to care.
Oh, kicking the show off now is our legal matters slot. Joining us in studio is Shanda Taran. Thank you very much for giving us a bit of your time. I know that diverse attorneys are in very, very popular demand. And you know, even though it's 8 o'clock in the evening, I'm sure you have piles of work to do, I'm sure.
Well, Nicholas, I'd like to believe I have piles of work to do. Not always the case, but I certainly am very busy at this time of the year. And, you know, it's, let me not moan about having too much work. When I came up to Johannesburg, I had no work. So it's much better the problems that too much work brings than, no work at all.
Totally. And, good problem to have.
A great problem to have. And also, you said you're working till 12 o'clock tonight.
Yeah. I mean, you know, no rest for the wicked. But then again, Palace is also working until 12 and Teng as well. I mean, geez, if I bring out a violin, they are just going to beat me to death with it. So
I thought I worked hard.
I promise you, a lawyer's working harder than journalists, but don't tell any other journalists. So the latest figures from Stats SA show that 44.4% of divorces in 2016 alone were couples whose marriages lasted less than a decade. It gives the impression that 4 out of every 10 marriages in South Africa is ending in the D word. A disastrous divorce, but you're here to tell us how it doesn't always have to end in the other D word of disaster.
Well, look, Nicholas, everything has a shelf life. And as I say to clients when they come and sit with me, is that's usually when we do the ANC, the matrimonial, the prenup. One day your marriage will end. It will end either by death or by divorce. If it's going to end by death, you need a will. If it's going to end by divorce, you need an antenuptial contract, obviously, before it ends by divorce. The stats that I have, based on my personal practice, is that I'd say 3 out of 5 marriages end in divorce within the first 10 years. Yes.
Just to break that down, is 60% of all marriages will end within the first 10, what do you say, 10 years?
I'd say 7 years. The 7-year itch is not just some figment of someone's imagination. I see it all the time. What's happening now, and I think internet dating and social media has played a phenomenal role in that.
Tinder and Facebook.
Tinder and Facebook, but not only that. It's just the choices that are available to people now that were never available. You know, my grandparents, I was thinking of my grandfather, who was basically, when he grew up, his choices as a partner, he probably had in the little town that he lived somewhere in the Karoo, he probably had 5 or 6 choices of girls he would marry. I can now sit with my wife in the house and communicate with 10 other women or 10 other people in what would be considered a cheating manner. Those options were not available to people. So social media is leading to a real erosion of the whole family structure, family values, one man, one woman. That really is becoming a very blurred concept. And if you're cheating with somebody or sexting with somebody over via social media, is it cheating in the traditional sense? Is it cheating with another person? A lot of things that people didn't have to deal with are now on the table, and which was never there when we thought of the traditional concept of marriage. And there are recent things that have recently come up and come off fast and hard. So it's causing havoc out there.
Legally speaking, if you're sexting or if you're Tindering or if you're scoping other people on Facebook while you're in the bounds of matrimony, are you cheating from a legal perspective?
Well, firstly, from a legal perspective, cheating has become largely irrelevant. There was a court case in September 2017 that before that you could sue a third party for breaking up your marriage. And the court there, the Constitutional Court, made a judgment there that said, listen, it wasn't the Constitutional Court, but it was the High Court that made a judgment that said there, if a person cheats, it's a symptom of a marriage that is already in trouble. It is not the cause. Therefore, you cannot now have a delictual claim, a damages claim against a person for you broke up my marriage. No, you also played a part in breaking up your marriage. If your partner was so happy, then why did they stray outside the bounds of marriage? Now, some people agree or disagree with that. That was quite a tool that we had as divorce lawyers to make a divorce settle quickly. Let's say, Nicholas, you are having an affair with somebody, you fall in love with that person, and once your marriage ends now, you then want to set up shop with that new person. If I, as a divorce lawyer, say to that person, I'm going to sue you and write them a letter, you've caused a breakup of the marriage, she will then say to you, listen, sort this thing out now. and the divorce settled quite quickly. So the court may have been right ethically in saying what they said, but they really took a tool away for settling divorces quite quickly.
Mm, mm. And a lot of them nowadays, you have to be honest, they don't always end in disaster, but they do very often end in acrimony. I mean, divorces come to an end for a lot of different reasons. Doesn't necessarily even have to be cheating. But when it does come to an end and things turn nasty, we start talking about things like protection orders. We start talking about the problem of children getting into the mess that is a breakup between two people that once upon a time maybe loved each other and created these children who are now pawns in really a game.
Yes. Unfortunately, children, Judge Dennis Davis gave a recent judgment in Cape Town where he said, and I'm sorry, Judge Davis, if I was quoting you, but he in essence said, it's so tragic to see that the children who get brought into the arena of conflict and gets used to exact from the one party via the court process to exact punishment on the other party. And he really, really came down on both parents quite hard, and rightfully so. Unfortunately, in a divorce, the children are generally the victim. And if my clients say to me they want to see blood on the walls, I say, sure, we can see blood on the walls, but no, it's going to be the blood of your children. Then they pretty much quickly change their tune, because as an attorney, I'm an officer of the High Court. I've sworn, whether I agree with the Constitution or not, I've sworn to protect the Constitution. The Constitution says the rights of the children are paramount. They are above all else. They are the vulnerable parties in the equation. And I am not allowed to act in a manner that is not in the children's best interest. If I do so, I can be disbarred. So I'm an officer of the High Court. The High Court is the upper guardian of all children, and we are all sworn to keep the Constitution, to act in accordance with the values of the Constitution, which puts the rights of children first. So when clients come to see me, I make it clear that I will not obey an instruction, and the members of the Gauteng Family Law Forum, which I belong to, we have agreed. We will not obey instructions which are not in the children's best interest. And if you then want me as a client to continue acting in such a way, and I've advised you against it, well then find yourself another attorney.
It's good to see that there's at least scruples among some lawyers in South Africa.
Yeah. What's the old saying? 99.9% of the rest, or the lawyers out there make the rest of us look bad. You know, the rest of us look bad. But anyway, the bottom line is there are very, very ethical attorneys out there, especially attorneys who practice matrimonial law. We get together once in a while because the group of us, the group that we play in, is quite small, specialist matrimonial attorneys, and we don't want to step on each other's feet. And let's say I'm representing a client, Nicholas, and you're representing a client, and there's a chance of settlement. But because you and I now have bad blood because of another matter, we don't settle this matter. That's highly unprofessional.
Yeah.
So we get together once in a while, and we sit and we chat and we just clear the air. And we've taken an arm's length agreement that when there's children involved, we will always attempt to mediate before we litigate. We will not send inflammatory letters to each other like it was done in the old day. And you,
but with every word costing R5 or whatever it is.
R5, what a discount.
Totally. But I get, yeah. I mean, it's good to see that the things that the legal profession has got a bad name for over the years seem to have changed. So we've spoken about how divorce should really be in the best interests of the children as enshrined in the Constitution, when we talk about the importance of ensuring the safety and security of children. When it does go pear-shaped, though, and it doesn't even need to involve children, when a divorce doesn't only end in tears, but it ends in violence and bloodshed, you need to start talking about things like a protection order, a restraining order, essentially.
Domestic Violence Act. That's the act you want to look at, Nicholas. And it doesn't just have to be divorce. You can be in a partnership. It says in the act, in a domestic partnership. So it could be a partner, an ex-partner. Doesn't matter if it's same-sex or not same-sex. And a domestic relationship can also be a family relationship. I recently got a protection order for a daughter against her mother. So it's some sort of relationship you were in with this person. And you can get a protection order against them. And for various acts, anything ranging from economic abuse, which I've never seen the courts grant, unfortunately, which is quite sad, to you can get emergency monetary relief, which the courts rarely grant. And then you've got the things that you and I would think it's for. Emotional, verbal, and psychological abuse, harassment, intimidation, I'm reading from the acts here, and stalking, sexual abuse, those kind of things that you and I would think is abuse, but also ancillary matters which you're supposed to be able to get, like economic abuse. When in a divorce now, you get kicked out of the house and the person leaves the home and he stops paying the bond. That would be economic abuse, that you would suffer, you and the children would suffer undue hardship. And you don't have to be married to use this. But a lot of times in a divorce...
Because there's such a thing as a common law wife, common law husband.
That is a term that does not exist in our law. Uh-huh. In other, and it's quite oftenly used. You know, people right now, because of the high divorce rate, because of just the pure economics of life and how expensive it can be, whatever, just because of the way the world is moving and the transient nature of the world at the moment, including the bonds of marriage, people are more and more choosing not to get married and making it as an active choice. Yet they are buying property together. Yet they are getting bank accounts together. They are, the affairs are intermingling. In other jurisdictions, and this I talk about European jurisdiction, if people have lived together for 3 years and or have a child together, there is legal status to that agreement. And they get, for want of a better word, pretty much get treated like they're married because society treats them as a couple. And in that case, there is recognition. In our law, common law marriages do not exist. So it's quite simply said in a court case, it said, if you want the benefits of marriage, i.e. reciprocal maintenance and things like that, guess what? You have to get married. So in our law, it's not yet recognized.
Wow.
Yeah.
Learning all sorts of things now about divorce, separation, cohabitation. No such thing as a common law wife or husband. If you have any questions about your marriage, about a potential divorce, a divorce that you may even be going through, we have our lines open right now, 011-883-0702. Niklas Bauer in conversation with Shandu Turan, attorney and matrimonial mediator in studio with us here on our Legal Matters feature this Tuesday. With you until midnight. Don't forget, next hour, we are going to be talking about climate change, fact or fiction. Ivo Vechter, as well as Professor Francois Engelbrecht, joining us between 9 and 10. You can also send us an SMS on 31702 and WhatsApps into 0727021702. Okay, so you touched on how people can get together without actually getting married, but let's talk about the separation part, that tough part, before we go back and put flesh on the bones of that protection order process. What are the different types of separation that you can undergo when it comes to a divorce or a cohabitation or a relationship coming to an end?
Well, I think you can go in two broad categories, the adult way and the non-adult way.
Okay, fair enough.
That's what I generally say to my clients. I say, we can try to do this the adult and the cheap way. When it comes to divorce, we can draw up a settlement agreement and a parenting plan now, try and aim for signature, and once we have it, we get divorced on an unopposed basis, fairly neutral summons that gets issued, parties wish not to remain married, parties have lost their love and affection for each other, and hereby we ask for the settlement agreement and parenting plan to be made in order of court. No ifs, no ands, no buts. Fairly cheap, fairly easy.
Just like ballpark, how long would that take and how much does it cost?
As I said to a client today, after last signature on the settlement agreement, you could be divorced within 40 days. It obviously depends on the court role, whether the court's in recess, which court you use. Ballpark figure. Once you have the last signature on the settlement agreement, it then gets endorsed by the family advocate if there's children, that it has to be in the children's best interest, and the family advocate looks at the following things. Are the children, do both parents play a meaningful role in the child's life? Is there a dispute resolution mechanism for, as in mediation, if they get involved in a dispute, and they will at some stage. I mean, the reason they got divorced is they're in dispute about stuff, and they're not, those disputes are not going to magically go away now, but they have to co-parent. So if they get involved in dispute, do they have a dispute resolution mechanisms, which usually includes going for 3 mediation, at least 1 mediation session before they go to court? Are the children properly maintained? I.e., do they have a roof over their head, medical aid, you know, basics or stuff like that based on the parents' standard of living? Mm-hmm. The extended family, what religion will the children be brought up in?
What type of school they'll go to and stuff like that.
The basic decisions, what are the rules of the game? As I explain to clients, it's basically you and your partner are now going to enter into a tennis game. Here we set the rules of the tennis game.
Seems fairly straightforward, but unfortunately, it doesn't always end up that way. We've got 3 calls on the line. Shandu Turan, our divorce specialist, attorney, matrimonial mediator in studio with us on our Legal Matters slot. John in Randburg, your thoughts?
Hi, Nicholas, and hi to your guest. I just have a question. Let's use a South African citizen. South African citizen gets married to someone from another country, and then the wedding happens in a third country, and then they get divorced. Which jurisdiction of marital law applies?
Okay, John, just say again, where did they get married?
So it's a South African citizen gets married to, let's say, an American.
Yes.
And the actual wedding ceremony takes place in, say, Portugal.
Okay.
Which jurisdiction sort of applies? Like, let's say then afterwards they get divorced.
Yes.
Which okay. legal... Yeah.
Well, John, thank you for starting off the night with the easy question.
Cheers, John in Randburg.
So basically, John, there was a similar court case like this where a South African girl got married, funny enough, to a Portuguese guy who they were working on a cruise ship in international waters. And the wedding happened on the actual cruise ship. So which law applies? There's an old law, common law, which is another name for saying law that goes back through the ages, which sometimes had similar problems. If there's a dispute, then the law of the husband applies. But in this case, let's say they were married. You get married in America, but you have children here in this country. Then the Children's Act, according to the children here, apply. And the court where the children are ordinarily resident would have jurisdiction. Now, cross-border marriages are quite common, and where the sometimes, if the parties, if what you sometimes have is assets in various jurisdictions, parties might be upwardly mobile, they might live here but have property in France. How do you deal with it? Well, usually those parties have an antenuptial contract that picks a law of a country to deal with it. But if you haven't picked the law of the country, then generally, if you stay in this country, the children are here and you have property here. We'll look at the law of the country where you were married. If you're married in the U.S., in the specific state that you were married, a lot of the states there have, as a default position, in community of property. They don't call it in community of property. They call it matrimonial property, which is not too far from our default position, which is in community of property. But then you have European countries and certain states, which the default position is out of community of property. So you look at where they were married, but you also look at where the assets were situated, and you look at more specifically where the children are ordinarily a resident. Also, if the parents have made South Africa their domicile and have South Africa their chosen home, there's a lot to be said for just sake of practicality. In the assets are here, the children are here, the parents are here. Well, then guess what? Let's try and sort it out via South African law. Let's not be too highfalutin and sophisticated. The courts generally have a practical approach. If you don't have an ANC, the children are here, the assets are here, you're living here, there's no reason why you can't get divorced in our courts via our law. But you can say that asset that's there in the United States, or that asset, that bank account that's there, that law should apply. And if you of the law of that country or that specific year, and if you have a good enough argument, the court will certainly listen to it. Of course, the other party will then say, no, that shouldn't apply because they want to keep the money in the bank account for themselves. And then one party will say, no, our law should apply the default. And you'll argue about that.
And the tennis game starts.
Yeah, and the tennis game starts. But basically, if the assets are here, you're living here, and the children are here, for most parts of the African law would apply, but there might be one or two exceptions as far as certain ring-fenced assets.
So let's talk about something that is not necessarily that common in Roman Dutch law, especially. John in Sandton, I see you. We'll get to you in a moment or so. But Zizi in Sandton, you have a question about Lebola.
Yes. Right. Hello. How are you?
Very Hi, well, Zizi.
Great. Thank you. Yes. I just needed to find out. You do a lobola, right?
Yes.
With your wife or fiancé. But now you decide you want to do an anti-nuptial contract.
Yes.
How do you remedy that? Say after you've been together, say just your lobola maybe 2 years ago, but now you want to do an anti-nuptial contract, whether with accrual or without accrual. How do you fix that kind of situation?
Okay, firstly, lobola, Zizi, lobola is seen as a gift. And many cultures has a gift, a dowry. Hindu cultures have a dowry that the one family gives to the other family. So that you can bring that into the depending on now there's different kind of matrimonial regimes. You know, we've got in community of property, we've got out of community of property, we've got in with accrual, and even out of community of property, you can be quite creative in your antenuptial contract. If you want to bring that lobola into the antenuptial contract, you can. You can say, okay, this is a gift to the other party. It should be excluded. Or should the marriage then break up, guess what? I want half the lobola back, or I want the whole lobola back. All of that can be brought in, but it obviously needs to be brought in by agreement. You can pretty much state what you want to happen with the assets. And you can make lobola an asset of the marriage, or you can make it a gift that was just given to the other side.
But once it's a gift, then you can't have any legal recourse.
It depends. You can ring fence the gift. You can say, okay, the gift then needs to be put into a trust for the children. You can be quite creative with it, but you need to some sort of agreement by it. A wedding ring is a gift, right? The marriage breaks up generally unless it's a family heirloom. The other party keeps it. You can't now say, oh, I want my ring back. You know, sorry, it's a gift. So the lobola is pretty much treated almost in the same fashion. However, you can pretty much decide how you want to treat it. You can also decide how, you know, generally, once you pay the lobola, more often it takes 10 to, or 20 years sometimes to pay off the full amount. So then there's that fight that also bubbles in the background, you know. Yeah, but you haven't finished paying the lobola. Are we truly married? And unfortunately, the Customary Marriages Act, and this is one of the pet peeves I have with the Customary Marriages Act, is that the Customary Marriages Act doesn't talk to the Divorce Act. There are two acts, and they don't really help each other. If you get married in terms of customary law is easy. You have to get divorced in terms of the Divorce Act. Now, here's where the problem comes in. Section 9 of the Customary Marriages Act says you do not have to register a marriage for it to be valid. But the Divorce Act says you need a marriage certificate to get divorced. So, and that creates major, major problems. Because if you are married in terms of a community of property, and you haven't an antenuptial contract, you are married in community of property. So it's much better for the one party to say with the assets, oh, sorry, we were only dating and I owe you nothing, versus saying, oh, you're married and here's half. But if you are already married and you want to register an antenuptial contract, it's not such a big issue. Get a specialist matrimonial attorney. You can have one drawn up and it can be registered after the fact. You just have to give your creditors notice, generally the bank, because where previously they could have sued both parties if it was in community of property, now it's out of community of property, they can then only now sue the one party. But it's fairly easy and straightforward to make an agreement or come to an agreement with them. But you can register an antenuptial contract after the fact. The Act allows for that.
Zizi in Sandton, thanks for the call. Let's go to John in Sandton. Remember, you can send us your SMSs as well, 31702. And you can also drop us a WhatsApp to 072-702-1702. Shanda Turan with me in studio here until 9 p.m. asking or answering all of your questions about divorce, separation. We'll get to protection orders before the hour's out. But John in Sandton, you have a general question about divorce attorneys.
Good evening, Nicholas and Shandu. I was very interested to hear Shandu talking about the ethics of practicing family law and his family law circle here in Gauteng. This is a tactic that really is reprehensible to me and as a lapsed attorney as well. Been recently divorced and the seed was planted in my ex-wife's mind that I had sexually abused my, at the time, 8-year-old daughter. There was no evidence because it didn't happen. The averments and the summons were bare averments with no evidence. And it, in my view, it just uses it as an intimidatory tactic to extract certain things from the, usually the ex-husband. Absolutely reprehensible. And my inquiries have led me to understand that this is quite a common tactic used. And I've even heard of an ex-husband who actually committed suicide. And the tragedy here is that I have this highly intelligent, beautiful daughter, top of her grade at school, and it's damaged our relationship. And I gave into the divorce because I wanted the best cash outcome for all of us. I suffered a chronic illness, which in part led to the divorce, and I just wanted to keep things tidy. But it's left a festering wound. And how does Shandy feel about this?
John, I feel your pain. Secondly, your situation is not unique. I've had many people that I would consider big, hard, tough guys sit crying in my office for the same reason. Unfortunately, not everybody has the same scruples that they should have. But I've noticed this as well. And if there's some form of custody dispute, at some stage, the averment of some sexual misconduct happens against the man. I've seen it happen more often than not. How do I disprove? And it's tough. It's averments that cannot be disproven. How do I disprove that I didn't inappropriately touch my daughter on the steps 5 years ago? How do I disprove it? It's like you muddy the water. You can't unmuddy it. Now, the court sits there, and they're in a difficult position. What if they say, oh, it's completely wrong, and they turn out to be wrong? It could be disastrous for the daughter. You know, but unfortunately, or fortunately for men, that averment is being made so often now that the courts are now becoming quite skeptical of that averment. It gets made in custody disputes quite often. At some stage, it comes up. Someone will say something. The aunt, the uncle, the grandmother, or the mother, or somebody in the relationship will say, oh, but 5 years ago in the bathroom, I came in and your hand was inappropriately on our daughter. How do you disprove that? So, John, I think there are attorneys out there who use it as a tactic. I agree with you that it's reprehensible. But fortunately, the courts have wisened up to that sort of line of, how can I say, running a case. That it wasn't there, your relationship with your daughter was fine, but now suddenly this has come up, and this has come up only in the divorce after the fact. Do you understand? So John, it is a tactic that some people have used. The people that I associate with certainly would not use that tactic. And if a client makes that averment, they better have real, real serious proof, and starting with something like a J88, which is a medical examination, proves it. Otherwise, you know the rule as well as I do. He who alleges must prove.
Yes.
So if you can't prove it, then, you know, you're actually putting yourself up for a beating. But I understand the pressure that you're under. I understand the pain that you feel. But let me tell you something else, John, and this I've also seen. At some stage, children sees the wood from the trees. And they do grow up, and their relationship with you will be restored. Of course, it helps too when people don't see the wood from the trees to have a lumberjack, i.e. a good divorce lawyer. But at some stage, you know what, your child will see the wood from the trees.
John in Sandton, thanks for being brave and sharing your story with us. If you have a horror story from your divorce that you'd like to discuss with Shanda Tehran, matrimonial mediator and attorney at law, with me in studio on our legal matters slot in 702, give us a call now, 011-883-0702. Couple of messages here on the WhatsApp line. I mean, there's this one question that I mean, it's a bit like asking how long is a piece of string, but a gentleman in Four Ways, John, wants to know, what do divorce lawyers charge on average from lowest to highest? I mean, it depends on quality. Quality over, you know, a divorce lawyer is a divorce lawyer is a divorce lawyer.
Right. Well, not quite. Compare a GP to a heart surgeon. The one is both are medically trained. Right, your GP will charge you 400 or 500 rand for a consultation. A cardiologist, who's a specialist doctor, a specialist physician, he may spend in total 12 hours with you, and that includes the operation, and your bill might run into the millions. Yet they are both doctors. Same with attorneys. You get your general practitioner, and then you get your specialist attorney, who is specialized in the area, practices only that kind of law like myself, and then so you've a specialist, you're playing in a very small area. And in my speciality is divorce law. But in that speciality, I have a further speciality, which is even a smaller group of people, which is custody for fathers and disputed relocations, where the mother or somebody wants to move the children to another country. And you are, as the other parent, are saying no, but that's not, was never the deal. So the more your specialization is, that smaller that field that you play in, the more you charge, the more knowledgeable you are on any subject. Same as a general practitioner versus a cardiologist. And thrown into that, your years of experience. It's almost been 20 years since I've been admitted. So my candidate attorney charges X rate, and I, as a specialist attorney who's been in the game for 20 years now and who's probably specialized for the better part of 12 years, where I only practice matrimonial law, all that's thrown in, I charge a higher rate. If you want the big dog, you've got to pay big dog prices. And it's that way for anything in life, the medical profession, engineering profession.
Journalism, so, even.
Is it?
No. Oh, not, nice, not at all.
Nice
not
Rolex necklace.
Yeah. Radio theater of the mind. Shandu, definitely not being honest about that. John in Cosmo City, you've got a question on customary law marriage.
Yes, I've got one. The thing is that the customary law marriage is confusing. What are the preambles and what are the documents required for it to be regarded as a customary law marriage?
I would agree with you that the Customary Law Marriage Act is confusing. It's confusing for anybody, and some recent court cases that's come out by the court has not helped and clearing up the confusion. What the Act says is that the person, you and the person have to be over, both parties have to be over 18 years of age, both parties have to consent to the marriage, and then the marriage has to be conducted in terms of customary, in terms of cultural customs. Now, what does that mean? In some cultures, it would mean the lobola has to be finished paying. In some cultures, it would mean the first payments had to be made. There had to be some sort of, what do we know is that there had to at least be a first payment of lobola or a lobola note of the agreed price. So tick that box. Second box is there had to be some sort of celebration. Now, what is some sort of celebration? Is it somebody getting together and having a couple of beers? Or is it a big wedding ceremony? Of course, it helps if there's photographic proof. Hey, here's our wedding. Here we are at the church. Here's the family. Here we're celebrating. And then there had to be the handing over of the bride. Now, there's a recent court case which has also taken that into question. What is the handing over of a bride? What it comes down to is that the one family, the one, your family or the bride's family says to the other family, here is your bride. You then accept it and say, here is my wife. And from that moment forward, you introduce each other as husband and wife. But it's very gray. It's very nefarious. And the courts, there are judgment, there are conflicting judgments about what this means. What if you have Sesedi culture and Pedi culture or Zulu culture, somebody from Pedi that marry Zulu and they have different customs, and you know, which one do we take? So it is very confusing, and a lot of I'm telling you now, there's a lot of people out there who think they are married and they're actually not, and there's also a lot of people out there who think they're dating and they're actually married. So it's a big yaw, and we're looking to the courts for clarity on this because the Act is poorly drafted and badly implemented.
Calls on all of your divorce matters, and I'm seeing that there's a trend. We don't want this to turn into a fest of a certain kind. Only men calling in. We also encourage all women to give us a call as well, 011-883-0702. We've got Vaughan in Benoni, Mark in Johannesburg, as well as Impo in Katlehong. We're going to get to you all, but we're going to go to Jason in Alberton first. Jason.
Hello. Yes, I just got a question. It's actually not for me. It's actually for my father. Basically, what it is he was married to my mom for 40 years. Okay, and then my mom passed away. He then got married to another lady, and they've been married for about 5 years or so, plus minus. And now they're getting divorced. Okay, and I just want to find out, how does it sort of work? Because, I mean, he was married to my mom for 40 years, and then they lived in that same house for 40 years. Now he married this other woman for about 5 years, and now they're selling the house. Where does that sort of leave, what does she get out? I mean, what does she get out with a property, where the property is concerned, for example?
Okay, Jason.
Thanks, Jason.
Jason, what it would depend on is how, in what sort of matrimonial regime they had. I'm assuming that since your father remained in the property, that based on the previous divorce agreement, he got the house or he bought out your mother. There was some sort of settlement regarding the property, or the house was excluded in terms of an antenuptial contract. But let's say your father married this woman and they didn't have an antenuptial contract. That would mean they're married in community of property. So she would then be able to claim half the house or half the value of the property. Now, it doesn't matter if she didn't contribute a cent to the house. If your father didn't want it that way, he should have had an antenuptial contract. However, this can lead to, rightfully, as you're thinking now, a very unfair result. Let's say somebody just married him to get him divorced so that they could share in half the proceeds, which does happen sometimes. People get married because they want to get divorced for monetary reasons. Or that, let's say, the divorce is squarely her fault. She, because of her attitude and her behavior, has caused the breakup of the divorce. Then you can say to the court, but in terms of Section 9 of the Divorce Act, that we should disregard the fact that they're married in community of property. It would lead to a very unjust and unfair judgment that she now, after 5 years of short marriage, gets, you know, she gets R500,000 or whatever the case may be, and therefore that should be forfeited. What it basically comes down to is the law or the principle underneath that, which is a sound principle, is that bad behavior should not be financially rewardable. So You can still then, if a person had a long-standing affair or there was violence or addiction involved and that caused a breakup of the marriage, well, then guess what? Then they shouldn't share in those proceeds. So if they were married in commutative property, she can claim half the right of that property. However, if she is the cause of the breakup of the marriage and her bad behavior should not be financially rewarded, then there certainly is an option in the divorce agreement to say, but that should be forfeited. That and my pension money, she should not be able to touch.
All right, keep those calls coming in. We've got a nice long list of questions coming in. 011-883-0702. We'll also check out the WhatsApp line for a second. 072-702-1702. From my understanding, very limited layman's understanding and also experience coming from a divorced family, it's not always the man that's on the wrong side of a wrong allegation. There's a particular legal term that that you referred to earlier.
Well, firstly, you're asking me what I referred to earlier, which is always dangerous.
No, there was an attorney that they called in earlier. Oh. That was a fancy word for an allegation.
Oh, he who alleges must prove. That is allegation, is the fancy word. But basically, Nicholas, we operate on a no-fault divorce
okay.
system. And that's also a term that's hard to grapple with. Previously, we had a system where if you behaved in what's called a morally reprehensible fashion, then there should be some punishment, generally financial punishment, in assets that you would share or not share in, or custody of the children or stuff like that. But then the courts came to the conclusion, but nobody is without blame in a divorce. Both parties said or did things they shouldn't have done and probably sorry about. And, you know, to expect people to act like the Statue of Liberty and stand there with virtue and poise in a very difficult emotional situation is just not realistic. So they said, right, but except for the forfeiture clause, which I now spoke about, fault and who's to blame generally doesn't really come into the picture anymore and doesn't relate to a financial punishment anymore. But unfortunately, people making spurious allegations, especially in custody matters and especially against fathers and especially on sexual misconduct, on matters you cannot disprove, it's quite common.
Quick one on the WhatsApp line, and I still want to get into the different types of separation you can go through before heading down the divorce road, and also the ins and outs of a protection order. We'll fit that in before nine. Don't worry, I'm a time optimist. But on the WhatsApp line, anonymous saying, I've got two properties and my ex-wife took the biggest one. We signed a divorce agreement that I should be paying the bond. And now that we're divorced, do I still need to be paying the bond of that house? Seems a bit obvious, right?
Yeah. If you signed a divorce agreement that says you're supposed to pay it and that was made an order of court, if you now stop paying without good reason, you are in contempt of a court order. If you stop paying for whatever reason, you are in contempt of a court order. But let's say you get involved in a car wreck, you lose your job, your business goes under. Okay, that's changed circumstances. The court will not then hold you in contempt and say, oh, but, you know, if you are in willful default and you signed an agreement, no one held a gun to your head, and you said, yes, this is what I'm going to do post-divorce. You might regret that agreement later on, and that's why I always give clients a cooling-off time. And I said to somebody today, we will not rush this. We will not allow the other side to put us under pressure. We will send them our version of the settlement when we are good and ready. I'm not going to exactly like this anonymous now, sign an agreement, and then a couple of years down the line, you think, oh, you know what? What did I sign? Because at that time, you were so emotionally low, so beat up. You would do anything just to change your situation. You don't care what you sign. You'll sign your life away. That's why I say to my clients today, we will not be pressured. They will not set a time limit for us. You will sign by, they send it to you on Thursday, and you will sign by Friday, or everything's off the table. We ignore that. We'll sign it and work through it and give it back to the other side when we're good and ready.
Vaughan Imbenoni, your question.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Vaughan.
Tell me, first, it's my question is a two-part question. What is your understanding of a universal divorce?
Universal divorce, Vaughan, I think what you're referring to is what's called a universal partnership. And that is the closest we've come to recognizing what's called, as Nicholas said earlier, a common law marriage. Muslim marriages, for instance, for a long time was not recognized. And it's still not fully recognized. They've been working on the Muslim marriages bill for some time now. Is what happened a lot of times is people were together in Muslim marriages for extended periods of time, and then suddenly the person divorced them according to Sharia law, and the wife and children were out in the street with nothing. So to combat that, the court came up with a very novel concept, a concept from common law, from old law, called universal partnership, where people were in a partnership for joint gain. It was a business concept, by the way. But if you look at a marriage, it is a partnership for joint financial gain. Then if the partnership then breaks up, there are certain default things you can ask for. And they tried to sort of bend that into the family law environment, where people who lived together, but it was specifically for the Muslim marriages, a conundrum that they had for Muslim marriages not being recognized. Then the other person could say, yes, but we were in a universal partnership. I gave up my life. I gave up my career to stay at home, to work, to look after the children. So you could go out and run a successful business. And there should be some monetary value compensation for that. So that is my understanding of a universal partnership. Very difficult to prove, by the way.
All right, Vaughan and Benoni, hope that answers your question. Let's go to Impo in Katlehong. Impo? Yes, Impo, go ahead.
Hi, Impo.
Yes, I have two questions. Like, I'm going to be divorced now. And one of the things is that the lady, when we got married, she came with a child before, and I came with two children. And we married our kids customarily. When she did a pleading, so she separated my kids as if they're not non-existent. And I was saying to them that we have five children. These kids are married customarily. They belong to this marriage. Now we have two houses, one somewhere, one somewhere.
Yes.
And in what I was saying is that take this one house and I take this one house. So if our kids do not stay without a house, if you know what I mean. And when I say our kids, for me, it's five kids. For her, it's very key. So now, that's a predicament for me because of now, we married these kids customarily, and customary law is at equal with common law, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
But in her pleading, she pleaded that, you know what, I have this child born out of wedlock, and then you know what, and she didn't declare the kids that I came with. And that's a predicament that I have. And we have two houses. One is paid off, one is not. And I was saying, in my pleading, that she must take the house that is paid off, and I'll take the one that is not paid off and continue with the payments and all those kind of things. The matter has not reached the court as yet. But, you know, we're still in the pleading stage. So I just need an advice.
Okay. So, Paul, what would I do if I was you? Firstly, I'd put what you said down, and I'd draft that in a settlement agreement. I'd draft the settlement agreement that deals with the assets of the marriage, and then the second section would be the parenting plan, which deals with the care and contact, how you see the children, when you see the children. And I'd send that to her as a without prejudice offer, which means that if the settlement negotiations don't succeed, then she can't now go to court and say, oh, but I want this section implemented and that section implemented because he did offer it to me. But I would send that to her, and then and we'll see what we agree on. And you'll find there's probably, out of the 40 sections in the settlement agreement and parenting plan, there's probably three or four you don't agree on. You agree on the rest. And for those three or four, I'd send you guys to mediation. And the mediator will sort out most of that. And then if you do go to court, you'll go to court on one issue. Who gets what house? And the rest will be sorted out. And that is, and that in itself will settle probably in due course. Because about 95% of divorces start as uncontested, but then end up as uncontested because the cost is just too prohibitive. If you want to spend R1 million to make R10 million, that's a good investment. But spending R1 million to potentially divide $300,000 in debt, that's a bad investment. A lot of
no sense.
People's financial situation is such that they're fighting about dividing debt, not dividing assets. And to spend ridiculous amounts of money on that is, I just do not see the sense in that. So cost of divorces are prohibitive. They really are. So if you want to spend R1 million to make R10 million, great, good investment. But if not, it's a waste. So I would have my attorney draw up that settlement agreement, send it to her and the parenting plan on a without prejudice basis. see what we don't, what we disagree on, what the issues and dispute are, and then proceed to mediation on that. And it might take away the whole need for the court process, or for not the court process, but for the whole litigation aspect thereof. You can potentially go to court at the end of it, at the end of a 3-month period after negotiations and mediation, go to court with a signed settlement agreement and go to court on an uncontested basis. You should always try and take that option.
Right. It's been an illuminating legal conversation about divorce, matrimonial law, and of course, how mediation can also play a role and not land you in the divorce courts. Now, I promised to talk about separations and the different types that you can try and pursue to prevent divorce. Very briefly, because time is always against us, what are the 4 different types of separation you can look into if you think in some way, shape or form your marriage may be salvageable?
Well, if your marriage may be salvageable, you know, that's more a social question than a legal question. The act is quite clear. If you're going to get divorced, you're going to get divorced, and there's a route to go. I always, the first thing I ask my clients is, if he or she came to you now and said, listen, I'm so sorry. I made a terrible mistake. I'm sorry about what happened. Shall we give it another shot? I always ask that. If that other party came to you now, right now, and said that, what would your answer be? And if your answer is, I'd consider it, then I say, well, I'm going to arrange a marriage counselor for you, and you give me an undertaking that you and the other party will go for 3 sessions. If after that it doesn't work out, please come see me, especially if there's children involved. I'm always, some of the most rewarding days, not financially rewarding, but emotionally rewarding days I've had in my legal practice, my legal career, is people reconciling on the steps of the court. And it does happen, and it should happen. So what kind of separations are there? In my book is this either, you know, you talk about this trial separation and conscious uncoupling and all of that. If there is a marriage or a potential a marriage is in dire straits, and it's because there's been violence, addiction, those kind of issues, then I think divorce, you should seriously consider a divorce, you know, especially with addiction and violence, and they run hand in hand, and the person has had now a long history of this, and it's not getting better, it's, as a matter of fact, getting worse. Then I think you should get divorced for your own safety, for your sanity. If there's been some other emotional, or if the person has developed serious psychological issues, schizophrenia, they're not bipolar, and lots of people, let me just come out and say it, bipolar is a very common catchphrase that people use for their actions, to try and excuse their actions. But real bipolar is something altogether very different. And I've seen very successful people, not people who sit at the couch playing Xbox and smoking weed all day and saying they're doing it because they're bipolar, but people who are financially successful, who work incredibly hard, top of the field, whose lives are ravaged by bipolar. If they stop taking their medication, they end up in situations which is not like the real them at all. And situations where they can't remember, where they do stuff completely out of character, extremely risky behavior. So I've seen people who's real bipolar. But I'm just saying, there are reasons sometimes when you absolutely have to get divorced, and when there's good reason for divorce. But my attitude is, if your marriage, if I ask that person that question, that's one of the first questions I ask people when they come and see me, especially if there's children. If that person came to you right now and begged for forgiveness and said they're so sorry, let's try again, then I say go for marriage counseling. So you can separate, you can do a trial separation, you can do all those things. But at the end of the day, if you're going to get divorced, you're going to get divorced. But if there's a chance of you reconciling, give it a bash. What do you have to lose?
Shando, I'd like to talk for 4 hours about divorce, because you just make it such an interesting topic, even though it's such a difficult thing to deal with in life. And of course, you know, with it being so common in South African society, it's always going to be a hot topic. How can people get a hold of you? Because we only had an hour. We were unable to discuss all the matters that pertain to divorce. Some 25,000 divorces a year in South Africa with all of their own circumstances. You have the experience. How can people find out more?
www.divlaw.co.za. That's divlaw as in divorce law, divlaw. Drop me a line on that website, or you can phone me on 082-819-5675. That's 082-819-5675. Drop me a call during office hours if you can. If it's an emergency, you can phone me anytime.
Shando Theron in studio talking to us about divorce and matrimonial law.